Welcome to the online dental mentoring service, where Dr. Derry Rogers and Associate Professor Michael Stubbs present clinical overviews and speak to dental leaders on the developing areas of modern day practice to assist you to develop and grow yours. Visit onlinedentalmentoring.com for more podcasts and training videos, all available free to our subscribers. We hope you enjoy today's show. Welcome back to our free series of podcasts as part of the online dental mentoring program. I'm Dr. Derry Rogers, and in the studio we have oral medicine specialist associate professor Michael Stubbs.
Hi, Derry. Great to be back in the studio.
Now, Michael, a lot of colleagues often ask about tips related to screening and diagnosing the early stage oral cancer. It's an important role we have as dentists to maintain the oral health of our patients, which sometimes also can save a life. What pointers would you recommend to our listeners about screening for oral cancer, Michael?
Well, look, thanks, Derry. I think the first thing is always consider patient risk factors. And when I'm referring to that, I'm talking about lifestyle factors particularly. So take a look at the patient's medical history. Have a look at smoking history, for starters. Now, sometimes a patient will indicate that they smoke and they might say 4 to 6 cigarettes a day. Dare I say, double it, because most times patients are being very conservative. Secondly, if they say they don't smoke, ask the question, have you ever smoked? Because some people, you know, stop smoking. They try and they might have only stopped for 2 weeks. Their risk factors associated with the use of tobacco and therefore carcinogenic, cancer-causing agents is still very high. And, you know, you might ask the question, do you roll your own or do you buy filtered cigarettes? The relevancy is those that roll their own have a higher exposure of the carcinogenic agents in the mouth than they do with those with filtered cigarettes. So I'm not suggesting that a filtered cigarette is healthier than a non-filtered cigarette, but what I am saying is getting an idea of exposure of carcinogens and its history of exposure is really important. Alcohol consumption. I mean, look, I think it's probably fair to say most Australians at least enjoy a good red wine, we would hope. But, you know, what some people can consider to be perhaps average consumption and what others consider average consumption can vary extremely. I had a patient who was quite surprised when he told me he used to drink a slab of beer, which is 24 cans. I suggested it per week, and he said, no, per day. He was quite surprised that I actually found that quite disturbing. So, you know, we look at alcohol consumption, and roughly what you're looking at is you're saying to yourself, okay, patient that smokes and a patient that drinks alcohol, they're risk factors for developing oral squamous cell carcinoma, which is by far the most common oral cancer that one sees in the mouth, is something like 35 times that of a patient who doesn't smoke and who doesn't drink. So, you know, alcohol and smoking does have quite a significant impact in risk factor. Cannabis use. Some colleagues might be a bit uncomfortable about asking that question, but one of the ways you can word it might be, you know, other than cigarette smoking, do you use any other recreational drugs? Now, a lot of people think cannabis is quite a harmless, natural product. Well, it can be. But we also realise for some patients it can make the difference between a patient who might be genetically susceptible for schizophrenia versus those that become schizophrenics. We also know that cannabis is considered a risk factor. In my own clinical experience, I've had at least 10 patients in my career to this point under 30, squamous cell carcinoma, predominantly the tongue, and cannabis was one of the commonly used drugs that they used. So don't underestimate the impact of cannabis. And we also remember too that HPV, human papillomavirus 16, is considered to be an important risk factor. We call human papillomavirus 16 an oncogenic virus. It simply means that once you've infected with the virus, you have it for life. But what it does is it inserts its own genes into your DNA. And those sites with which the human papillomavirus 16 inserts its genes particularly target genes which regulate cell development and cell growth. And so people that who have a biopsy and they're diagnosed with squamous cell carcinoma are often having the same specimen tested via immunohistochemistry to see if they're HPV 16 positive. Now, the only value I can say about that is that we know that a lot of patients who are HPV 16 positive, who have an SCC, their chances of survival is far greater. They'll respond better to radiotherapy and chemotherapy than a patient who's got a primary squamous cell carcinoma in the mouth because of smoking and alcohol. And one of the reasons for that, it seems, is that with the exposure of the carcinogens, smoking and alcohol, particularly in combination, the tissue, the mucosa, has a phenomena we call field of cancerization. It just simply means that the entire area is potentially exposed and susceptible to the cancer-causing agents. Whereas with HPV-16, when you develop an SCC, squamous cell carcinoma, and you only have HPV-16 positive and you're negative for those other risk factors, your chances of survival are greater. And, you know, previous history of cancer, I mean, if you've got a patient who's had a oropharyngeal cancer, let's imagine a patient sits in your chair and actually has a previous tongue cancer, and you're observing the tissues and you start to notice a bit of an unusual change or difference in the tissues, you always got to think, you know, is this another primary cancer? Is this a reoccurrence of the cancer? Remember that these patients have usually had radiotherapy. And so if you're thinking about radiotherapy, what does that cause? Dryness of the mouth. But it also predisposes the patient's jaws that you can't just take a tooth out. You need to consider the fact of wherever the area was irradiated as part of their treatment, that in fact, if you're taking a tooth out, the bone won't heal because it doesn't have a blood supply. So these are very important considerations. And remember, folks, we're just talking about the oral medical history at the moment. So, you know, we move into the mouth, and every tissue in the mouth, every mucosal site potentially is a risk site for oral cancer. But if I could say to you three sites particularly, is the lateral ventral surface of tongue, floor of mouth, and the retromolar pharyngeal region are the high-risk sites. Different schools of thought think different reasons why. One of them might be because a patient may develop a tumour, often they're asymptomatic, and it can get quite extensive before the patient ever notices it. That's where we come in as dentists. We're supposed to be the ones that notice these things when we review our patients. Secondly, there is a view that perhaps these sites, the mucosa itself, is more vulnerable to carcinogenic agents, cancer-causing agents. Floor of mouth, for example, exceptionally thin membrane. I know many times when I've done biopsies on the floor of the mouth, one has to be exceptionally careful when you're removing a lesion not to go through the floor of the mouth and then get an unexpected surprise from a sublingual saliva gland deciding to pop up in the perforation. And even more importantly than that, the third thing is, you know, sometimes in these sites, patients who have an oral cancer often only develop symptoms, pain, late stage. So when someone comes to me and they've got a painful ulceration or tissue change in the mouth, and I suspect that a squamous cell carcinoma is one of the diagnoses, I already know the likelihood of that metastasizing, spreading, is actually quite high. And it's really interesting too, you know, because, Derry, what still floors me is that we look at the current treatments that we do available these days for treating patients with squamous cell carcinoma in the mouth, SCC. So we look at radiotherapy. We have PET scans. PET scans are very, very finely susceptible imaging, which picks up minute changes or tumours that may have spread within the lymph glands and other soft tissues. And yet, even with our knowledge and understanding of treatment, the survival rates of patients who have an oral SCC in 2021 is about the same as what it was in the 1960s. And the reason for that is because it's diagnosed late stage. And so, you know, one of the biggest things you can do for your patient is, if you're not sure of something, if you look at the tissues and you say to yourself, that doesn't quite look the same as the opposite side, you know, could it be something unusual? Could it be something potentially sinister? There is no harm in referring that patient off for a biopsy. And most patients, I think you'd agree, Derry, would be appreciative of the dentist taking the time to actually refer them off than just looking at the lesion, thinking, not sure what that is, let's move on and let's look at the dentition.
So, Mike, does that mean that you biopsy everything that looks strange?
Good question. No, I'm not like a, perhaps dare I say, a surgeon where every person gets an operation. But what we do is we do use logic and we look at the mouth, and if we say to ourselves, look, that doesn't look normal, especially if you've got a one side, one region tissue change, the question you always ask yourself is why? Why is it there and, say, on one side of the tongue and not the other? And they're the ones we have high degree of suspicion for, and they're the ones we would biopsy.
So I would presume then, Mike, that if it's of a dental cause, such as a fractured tooth, a rough area that's rubbing against something, if the dentist can't link it to an adjacent rough area, ideally a photograph of it with a periodontal probe adjacent to it, so at least you can see the size, review it at 10 days, and if the dentist then still sees the issue is there or the ulcer or irritation has grown, it's off to the oral surgeon or oral medicine specialist such as yourself. Is that a good overview?
Yeah, that's an excellent summary, actually, because, look, there's a couple of things. I think one is photography is really important because it's subjective. So you put your perio probe next to a lesion and just imagine you take a photograph 10 days later, patient comes back, there's no change, or in fact the lesion's got bigger. When you refer that patient, let's imagine you send the photographs first for an opinion. Often we can look at the photographs, provided that you can send us a history of the problem and, more importantly, a summary of their medical history. We can usually make judgments. Does this patient need a biopsy or don't they? What's the likelihood of the condition being benign? In other words, just irritation on the from a sharp tooth. Is it inflammatory? Is it infection-based? Or is it, of course, cancerous? And the second thing is, and the value of this is that if you do have a lesion and you're not certain about what to do about it, you know, you've only got to either pick the phone up or, in particular, a lot of my colleagues who refer to me send me the images on drmichaelstubbs@hotmail.com. And when we receive the images, we do respond back to you and give you some structure or some suggestions about what you may or may not need to do with that patient. And the other thing is, when the patient comes to see someone like myself, it could be 2 or 3 weeks from the time you've written the referral. If you've got a photo with a perio probe, and let's imagine it was 10 millimetres, and I see the patient and it's only 2 millimetres, it's demonstrated to me that it's already healing. That's very invaluable information. Obviously, if it was 20 millimetres, I think it's fair to say we could both determine that it's getting worse. We would be very proactive in biopsying that lesion to determine why you have the problem, why the patient has a change in that area.
And Mike, I guess there's so many viruses around at the moment, varicella zoster and the like, and herpetiform ulcers that can also manifest themselves as some as the nasty. So the photograph's imperative, the size of it's imperative, and the medical history to go along with it.
Yeah, and look, one of the things I always do appreciate too is, particularly anyone that's got a patient sitting in where they've got a gingival lesion, send an OPG as well. Because, you know, a picture says 1,000 words. I mean, to have a clinical photograph, an OPG, and a good medical history, boy, I'm halfway there already and I've never met the patient. So I can certainly give some good advice based on that information.
And I think an OPG is a great standard screening test for all new patients. We're fortunate we have our own OPG in-house, and the various things that you can see, whether it be spine-related, calciotops related to calcifications in carotid arteries, sinus issues or the like, and it's I'm sure, a whole lot easier for you to at least start the diagnostic process with that radiology in hand from the outset.
Oh, yeah. And, you know, I don't mind saying, as part of our oral med training, we did forensic dentistry, not particularly an area I enjoyed doing, I must say. But the OPG was invaluable, because any person that needed identification, to have an OPG radiograph summarised the dentition that was there, the shape of the restorations, and you could compare with specimen, it was actually invaluable. They're gold. And I think it's fair to say any new patient having an OPG radiograph is actually a good thing.
So, Michael, if you were to summarise in a few comments what to look for, what would you suggest to the issues in terms of screening for dysplasias or oral cancers?
Well, I think, firstly, look at risk factors. So review your medical history as you would before your patient entered the room. and see what their smoking history is like, see what alcohol consumption is like. Second, see if they've actually ever had a previous oral cancer or oropharyngeal cancer. And more importantly, thirdly, when you're examining the tissues, always, as we mentioned in the previous podcast, go through a routine, a process where you evaluate every surface of every tissue, because the point is, at the end of the day, you're doing your patient a great service by doing that. And if something does not look right, then it means follow that patient up, and usually 7 to 10 days is a reasonable time frame. And if there's still no change or improvement, take a photograph either initially and then 10 days later. Do a perioprobe if you can to measure the size of the dimensions of the lesion, and always be assured that you can send the images to a specialist oral medicine or oral maxillofacial surgeon and get some opinion or advice about management. When in doubt, we do biopsies. And the reason we do it is because it's an opportunity to actually define what the condition is without speculation.
Mike, in last comments, a view of examining submandibular glands, posterior neck glands, sublingual glands, and obviously advising the patient beforehand doing it, what's the percentage of link between a positive oral cancer finding and lymph node enlargements?
Well, the thing is, one of the problems you have is that there is a quite a significant variation between what sometimes a colleague will palpate an enlarged lymph gland versus it between another colleague palpating the same thing. But if you had a patient, let's imagine, who had an ulceration in the mouth, and when the patient sits up in the chair, get them to drop their chin slightly downwards. So as you're rubbing the skin of the neck, particularly along the sternocleidomastoid, which, as you know, is where the significant or one of the significant chains of lymph nodes exist, you're actually rubbing the skin between your forefinger and your thumb, and you're feeling for pea size or firm like nodules or swellings. And you work your way from the gonial angle down the neck of right to the clavicle region. And you can then move your fingers forward again, like rolling the skin between the finger and the thumb, and you work your way more forward towards the midline of the neck anteriorly. And you do that bilaterally. But always get the patient to drop their chin down, and that way you get the opportunity to palpate the structures. It is, and it has been shown, there's a lot of variability between palpating lymph nodes and actually having enlarged lymph nodes. And so what ultimately we would do is imaging. But if you suspect a patient has enlarged lymph glands, you suspect that there is a change in the mouth that you're not consistently sure of, particularly I'm talking about mucosal, it's worthwhile getting that patient further followed up.
Fantastic, Michael. Great idea and great thoughts there, and I'm sure there is going to happen in many of our lives in our dental practices. We're going to see one to two of these in a lifetime. I think I've probably seen now about 10 of them. All have been unfortunately positive oral cancers, but all patients still alive and doing well. So please remember to go to our website, onlinedentalmentoring.com, for some sample photographs as to how we take pictures with the periodontal probes, and a summary of the screening examination that that Michael has certainly taught me and uses as a standard screening tool. So until next time, it's goodbye from me.
And it's goodbye from me.
We hope you enjoyed today's show and invite you to visit onlinedentalmentoring.com to subscribe to access more free podcasts in our video library, and also be able to submit your questions for our panel discussion podcasts. And remember, tell your colleagues about us if you feel they benefit from the information that we've presented. Until next podcast, take care.